Around the year 1395, King Richard II commissioned a portrait of himself for Westminster Abbey, in which he was shown crowned and holding the orb and sceptre of state, staring out frontally like an iconic close-up of the face of Christ. It was originally a wooden panel portrait, the earliest portrait of an English monarch, which some have suggested was done by the court painter André Bouvigny. Their heavily lidded eyes seem to follow you around when you stare at them, and the long, wavy, straw-coloured hair sits below a majestic and slightly over-large crown of state. The king wears a green tunic decorated with the letter R. He has a crimson robe lined with fur, an ermine cape, vermilion socks and gold shoes. It's a striking image. The king wanted an almost Christ-like sense of majesty and regality to radiate from the portrait, and this was deliberate. After having been humiliated by the Lords Appellant, Richard II had come to realise that he had no loyal army of supporters ready to fight for him. That power was projected from himself, and he clearly had lacked it in the past. The young king sought to create this image of divinely inspired regalness for himself. And we know this was happening because of other evidence. From around 1391, a richer and more formal language of address to the king was introduced. Previous to 1391, any petitions in Parliament, written by the Commons of England, were worded where they showed due respect to the monarch, referring to kings as their rightful and gracious lord. But now, the Commons' petitions had to be addressed to Your Highness and Royal Majesty, or to Your Most Excellent and Powerful Prince. The terms Highness and Majesty began to be used more and more around the court, and this image, this portrait of him, was seen as part of this movement. It is iconic, literally like a religious icon, and as we said, this is deliberate. The king was reinforcing his divine status, a man placed in this position by God himself, separate from everyone else. If he had no armies, he wished to create the impression that he had God on his side. Richard II was becoming a new type of king, somewhat shallow and fragile, but determined that his rank should be obeyed. And while he was doing this, London starved. Reports came in of a famine in the city, where food shortages caused grave difficulties for the residents, and what food there was hideously expensive. It was a city now gripped by a vicious recession, and in the face of this majesty, London was about to learn the hard way that this doe-eyed young king was a creature most petty and spiteful and powerful. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the chronological history of the city in regular weekly parts. We have reached the year 1391 and the years that followed straight afterwards, and explore an extraordinary period where this king was to turn on London and remind them who was in charge, and in the process, genuinely changed the city. Welcome then to chapter 141 of The Story of London. Majesty. Before I start getting into this episode, a slight diversion. I received a question from one of my listeners, and that is wonderful, as I do not often get questions from them, and I'm always open to them. So, let's get into it, because I really do enjoy questions like this. The question went, and they didn't leave their name, so whoever you are, thank you so much. Quote, I'm a little lost on the differences between mercers and grocers. It would be really useful if you could do one session on all the terms, e.g. draper, vintner, grocer, alderman, what is a guild, via craft, can a grocer be an alderman, how do we end up with the mercers and the fishmongers being opposed to the grocers and the drapers, or something like that. I know you have explained it before, but this was probably back in chapter 108, unquote. These are brilliant questions, and I'm more than happy to answer them. And hopefully the explanation I'm about to give will help clarify things. I also think it's a good idea to start explaining away some of the terms and terminology I've been using in the last few episodes. So what follows is a guide to jargon, lingo and terminology, just briefly. Let's start with the crafts and the guilds. Part of the confusion that comes when you're trying to explain the past, I think, I discover it is because I'm using a whole bunch of differing historians' work to base my episodes upon, and they all use slightly different terms to describe the same thing, and I've been using these terms as I go along. How best to describe this? I think, to sum it up, the bottom line difficulty is how I describe the rich men of London who ran the city in this era. In today's language, they'd be called oligarchs. Rich men who use their wealth to make sure they and their fellow rich men remain in power. So they are the oligarchs of the city. But in the past they were never called that, and that term has a whole bunch of modern connotations to it, which do not apply fully to the past, so historians like to be a tad more precise. You see, many of them refer to these oligarchs as the... Well, they pointed out that these men were running London by controlling the position of aldermen, right? So these same oligarchs are being called in many books the aldermanic class of Londoners. And when we say aldermanic class, this is who we mean. But long-term listeners will know that way back when the city first got its mayor, this class of citizens was known by the Norman French term eschevin. Basically, eschevin or aldermanic class or oligarchs are three terms that refer to the same type of people. Keep that difficulty in mind, as I hope I'll explain away how similar terms can refer to different people as we define things going ahead. Let's get onto the guilds. Guild is a catch-all term for a medieval trade association that existed in urban regions during this time. They were fraternities created by workers in certain professions. They were created, in the case of London, out of economic need. At times of great economic difficulty, members of the same profession would meet up and to try and aid themselves and each other by working together mutually. Of course, London being London, things got a little more complicated. So you have to take on board that such fraternities were originally not allowed. Groups of blacksmiths coming together to form a guild of blacksmiths so as to make sure their prices are consistent and members are not undercutting one another, that is, bottom line, an exercise in power. And back then, anything that gave power to people meant it took power away from other people. Other people with swords and the legal right to hit you over the head if you threatened their power. So just know, you could not have such power unless you were willing to pay for it. So the crown in its various incarnations was always on the lookout for revenue streams, and it became a thing to allow people gain this power, provided they paid. You want to form a guild of blacksmiths in London? Sure, just pay up. And when you paid, you were given a receipt. Officially it was a royal warrant that said we have permission to do this, but it was a receipt. This ban, by the way, also did not stop people from creating these guilds. As we've documented in previous episodes, in the past, illegal or adulterine guilds would exist, which would do the same thing without a royal warrant, and the state would eventually fine these groups lots of cash for trying. So that in itself is an ongoing thing. Now, one of the issues is London, despite it being tiny compared to London today, just a square mile, was also quite big and very busy, and because of that, people in one side of the city may not know or associate with people on the other side of the city. So it was kind of hard to form a guild of blacksmiths across the entire place. What happened then is that local groups of profession would meet up and organise based on their local parish churches. These became the religious fraternities, and I've focused in the story of London on the growth of the Pepperers of London, as they are actually one of the best examples of how a religious fraternity could end up becoming a trade guild. The men who imported and exported pepper and spices into London, and who lived in the parish of St. Atheline's Church, had come together and formed the Fraternity of St. Atheline's, a bunch of pepper merchants who would function as a trade federation and in all ways a guild for the local merchants. And since within their parish was a series of spice merchants who had all set up shop on a street called Soper's Lane, they were neighbours as well as pepperers, and the fraternity became linked to that region. Time passes. The Fraternity of St. Atheline had started out working against the interests of pepper and spice dealers up in Cheapside, say, or elsewhere in the city. But as they grew in wealth and power, and as economic hardships hit the city, eventually more and more pepperers wanted to join this fraternity. The fraternity, since it was based in a parish church, did not need a royal warrant, as it's a religious fraternity. And so it slipped between these bureaucratical cracks and continued to grow. And as we've seen over the episodes, and this was one of the reasons why I picked on the pepperers all along, what eventually happened was that as they grew in number and wealth, they became more organised, and this organisation allowed them to increase their power, and they became involved in aldermanic politics, and eventually they were able to use this power to become a formal guild with a royal warrant and everything. And just to make matters a little bit more complicated, their very profession changed and its members' interests were diverse and changing. Best way to explain this, members of fraternities and trade guilds started to see money-making opportunities which they could invest their profits from their profession into, and this opened up other avenues and revenue streams for them. We covered this back in chapter 108 with the brief moment where a bunch of rope makers of London became very, very rich. The rope makers were supplying ropes and other materials to German merchants down in the Steelyard, and because of good relations with these Germans, the ropers started getting into selling off products the Germans did not want to bother with the complicated selling and distribution of. Germans would sell their newly arrived products to the rope makers they knew in London for a good price, and they would then sell these on at an even better price, making serious cash. And their neighbours, the dealers in peppers, thought, I want a bit of that action, and got involved with it also. In time, while the rope makers lost this reputation as the wide boys of London, the spice dealers managed to keep going and started jumping away from their normal trade in dealing with pepper and into the lucrative big-time business of wool importation and exportation. And from this got into moving foodstuffs in bulk. And as I described in the previous chapter, when this fraternity of spice dealers of St. Atheline Parish decided to formally become a guild, they became the Guild of Grocers. This is how guilds could emerge and develop, and as time goes by, some of these guilds' interests did diversify like this. And now let's just add an extra level of complication, because it's London. Because while we're talking about all the guilds of London, they were not called guilds at the time. They worked under a plethora of names. And one name I've mentioned occasionally but refuse to use in the podcast is mestery. The mestery of a profession is a way of describing the people who organise and run it. It's like a ministry, but since ministries are run by ministers, mesteries or mysteries are run by masters. And that term I excluded because it was just confusing, I felt. The most common term for guild in this period was company. Not in a company like Apple or Tesco's or Walmart is a company, but company as in a military unit. And they gained this name because, as I described in the chapters which go over something called the Livery Wars, the members of each guild would like to band together and wear uniforms or distinctive clothes or badges. And these uniforms were called the liveries, and thus, when a bunch of members would gather together, they would be a livery company. And because of this, the great medieval trade guilds of London are universally known as the great livery companies, or the worshipful companies of the city. And this applies to all the guilds. And they covered a diverse body of men doing a diverse body of work. And some of these were based on crafts. So blacksmiths would be a craft guild. And they'd be referred to as a craft guild or simply as a craft. So basically all those who did make things with their hands became the craft guild. So our blacksmiths, the coopers who made barrels, the masons or the stonemasons, the carpenters, the saddlers, and those crafts. And historians will use the term crafts to refer to them collectively. Several other companies were based around the importation and exportation of foodstuffs. So we're talking the vintners and the fishmongers and the bakers. These dealt in making money from things to eat and drink and thus became known as the victuallers. And since the bedrock of their profession was dealing in victuals, aka food and drink. And this explains why London split politically between the victuallers and the non-victuallers, or the victuallers and the crafts. The rivalry came about because the victuallers could and did influence the price of food, which was the principal ongoing cost of the members of the crafts guilds, and so they would want the victualler guilds to keep prices low. Due to inflationary forces, the victualler guilds could rarely actually do that. But everybody blamed them for rising prices, accusing them of hoarding goods, hence why they became known as engrossers, as they engrossed their wealth from hoarding materials. With me so far? I hope so. Now, just when you think things can't get any more complicated, unfortunately they do. And why? Because the power of the guilds or the livery companies was based on the power of the city or town they were based in. So guilds would not work today because we operate under the system called free market capitalism. A local merchant being the only person to sell local products to customers would utterly fail. I mean, most of us don't have a factory just outside our towns making iPhones, right? But in the much simpler world of medieval period, the implicit power of the guilds was only local goods created or made or sold by locals would be allowed, because the local community would ban anyone from outside the local community from doing so. So a blacksmith, say from Ipswich, was forbidden from selling their wares in London by the blacksmiths of London, backed up by the city authorities. Hence you have the guilds becoming involved in who made up and enforced the bylaws of the city, the aldermen. They wanted to make sure that the people who ran the place were the people who would want to enforce their trade monopoly. And this ended up taking various manifestations, but ultimately, this is why London hated foreigners trading in London, and used the term foreigner to apply to everyone not from London, not just people from foreign nations. And thus, the London Livery Company's powers depended upon the ancient rights and traditions of the city, which would enforce this monopoly. And now, because of this, the city had to get involved in high politics, as kings of England actually wanted to expand trade in their bigger city, and so often sought to remove these ancient rights of London. And therefore, the livery companies would seek to influence who became the leaders of London, so the leaders of London could defend the right of Londoners en masse to maintain their monopoly of local trade run by local people. And usually they did this by bribing the kings to allow them to continue. Meanwhile, take on board, the titles of the guilds refer to the members' usual professions in London. A rope maker made rope. But as we've seen, some rope makers also became involved in the import and export of wool. Indeed, import and international exports did not have a specific guild managing that at this time. So this is why you had grocers involved in the wool trade, and you also had other people involved in international trade. And guild members who became successful could become merchants, and merchants who became successful moved to London and then sought out a guild to join to access the political power of things. This was also why London was all up in how the state ran compulsory wool markets, which were known as staples. And as I've said, this explains why the primary principal political faction across several guilds, including fishmongers and grocers for a long time, was the stapler faction, people who were all up in being concerned about the wool staple. Ha! The mercers, by the way, were general merchants in this era, while the grocers had been spice merchants but now generally dealt in foodstuffs. And both of them were involved in international exports of wool and cloth products, but as we said, the title refers to what they were doing in the city. Mercers were general merchants, grocers were general food merchants on the whole. The drapers dealt in being merchants in wool and cloth across the city and the country. The fishmongers or stock fishmongers dealt in fish, but because they had access to fishing boats, could also have exporting links. The goldsmiths were the bullion dealers, skinners were the dealers of fur product, and the guild and fraternity of St. John the Baptist of the City of London eventually became the merchant tailors. So I hope that kind of explains things. I don't know if it does, but that was a try. Okay, let's get into our story for this episode. By 1391, all of these groups I've just mentioned had to deal with a horrendous new reality. The economic conditions within the city and the realm came back to slam into London and hard. There were food shortages. Some sources even claimed there was a famine. The bottom line was that by the 1390s, the economic reckoning of this era was hitting the city of London. The result of diminished output of coins had seen London merchants and guilds, like the royal government, cope with this in the decade before by extending credit. They could do this as their overseas trade expanded. The credit which the various grocers of London gave to their customers and the debts they themselves incurred because they're paying in credit more than doubled during the 1380s. And at the same time, the king was borrowing heavily in the 12 years from Richard's accession until 1389. And 29% of all his loans were funded by the City of London, either as a city corporate or from private loans from their citizens within it. But then along comes the 1390s, and this pattern changes. The loans raised by the Crown dropped by more than half, but the City of London continued to provide the same proportion of them, again roughly 30%. It was clear that the King still needed as much cash as he always did, and his main income from wool customs was no higher in the second half of his reign than in the first, so he always needed to borrow cash. But the reason why the number of loans dropped was simply that about now, he was beginning to discover it was hard to find people willing to loan him money with everything going on. And London itself had refused, after the Parliament of 1389, to give the King any fresh loans on the grounds that, since they'd lost their liberties, they were not richer than any other merchants in the country. That year, they lent the Crown less than a third of the amount they'd given him the previous year, and their loans further diminished, to the point that in 1391, they lent him not one penny. London had decided that without special treatment from the state, there was no incentive to grease the wheels of the state. They wanted a return of their special treatment. And that doe-eyed king, growing in confidence, decided he would give them special treatment all right. In February 1392, the king ordered the sheriffs of London to draw up a list of everyone in the city who had property that collected rents of more than £40 a year. This was because, with that much money coming in, they were eligible for knighthoods. No, honest, they were. And they were going to be made knights. Of course, they had to pay for that, with cash, obviously. In response to this, the sheriffs of London replied that no one in the city had rents of that amount. Sorry, Your Majesty. Shortly thereafter, the king simply demanded a loan of £1,000. Straight to his face, the city refused, claiming poverty. This defiance was London sending a message to the state. It revealed that even if Parliament was claiming it had the right to choose the location of the wool staple, London was the grease of the state's wheels. There was part of what they were doing was them clearly trying to make the point that if the king wanted the loans he so needed, and he used to get from the likes of Nicholas Brembe, where London was basically his own personal piggy bank, then he had to improve their commercial interests and restore the city's privileges. However, behind this, there is evidence that the city actually could not easily afford to be so generous as it had been, that the economic conditions were devastating merchants and crafts of the city, really hard. From records from the mercantile courts of this era, we can see that the amount of credit extended by the grocers dropped by half from what it had been in the decade before. And the evidence seems to show that although the demand for credit from the cloth industry was increasing, the ability of importers of raw materials to give it was diminishing. They could give less credit to their fellow grocers, who were distributors and retailers, and they in turn, by the end of the decade, could no longer meet the cloth industry's needs. And we see all this in the rise of high-profile bankruptcies in London, and it became clear that the likes of Nicholas Brembe had kept several grocers financially solvent, and with his death, many of London's leading merchants found themselves going under. The year 1389 proved to be a devastating one for the Grocers Company, in which no fewer than six of their leading merchants were bankrupted. The majority of them were associated with the late Nicholas Brembe. As money now became tighter, so credit had been extended well beyond the ability of the debtors to repay, and the chain of credit was now much longer. You start seeing more and more grocers go under from debts lent out to others, and because they went under, these others also began to slip between the cracks of bankruptcy. Across London, huge sums of money was beginning to be written off as, quote, desperate debts, unquote. This was money people owed but could not claim, and therefore now could not pay the money they owed to others. It was a credit crunch, but without any banks to collapse, but with creditors, even mighty ones, going under. Take, for example, the rather rich Londoner Richard Tookey. He died in 1391. His estate showed that he was owed debts amounting to £126.06.08, and these were owed to him by debtors from as far away as Shrewsbury and the Isle of Wight. The inventory of his possessions show that he was still living well. His house was richly adorned and splendid, and he'd retired some years earlier. So most of his physical wealth was now in the form of property around London. This was sold after his death, and it raised £322.85.04. The total value of all his assets was £379.15.09. But he himself owned £194.16, of which nearly half was due to a loan to a single fishmonger taken some years earlier for supplies of dyes and alum. Tookey was not near bankruptcy when he died, but the desperate debts he was unable to collect amounted to one third of the value of his assets, and his own debts more than half. In fact, when he died, the only cash he possessed was £3.06.08. So Richard Tookey, who was sitting there rich and splendid, was actually very cash short and only just keeping his head above water. And it was these conditions that had faced London when a bad harvest hit and the Crown decided to end the foreign wool staple. And in January 1391, the entire network of credit was in danger of total collapse. One chronicler described children crying on the streets with hunger because there was no money to be had, and the wool intended for export lay locked up in warehouses as no one could get any credit to buy it. Once wool was sitting around being unsold, even the commons were convinced of their own mistake, and Calais from the midsummer of 1392 was once again made the compulsory overseas wool staple. And so given this genuine borderline credit crunch, while London not paying the Crown loans was partly them seeking to gain from the King their commercial privileges, there was also the reality that the city was flat broke and only just keeping its head above the raging waters of an ongoing credit crisis. But when you look at that painting of that young King with his huge golden crown on his head and his splendid vermilion socks, he does not seem to be the kind of young man who would understand how financial systems operated, or the kind of person who would recognise the nature of a credit-based economic contraction. In fact, you get the impression that he would not understand it at all, and he would see things from his own rather venal and inward-looking perspective. From his point of view, the Londoners had just been given what they wanted. The wool staple had returned to Calais, and the residents of the city had even been given the right to export directly to the Mediterranean. He saw one grocer, William Vella, make use of this newfound privilege to export Welsh wool from Southampton to Genoa. To the king, this was not one merchant suddenly finding a much-needed opportunity to generate income. Oh, no. To the king, this refusal of London to pay him money, this was bullshit. London's merchants always pleaded poverty. If they were not willing to voluntarily pay him cash, then they will be made to do so. It's worth remembering that King Richard II had not forgotten that in the time of his greatest need, only Sir Nicholas Brembe of London had stood by him. And these other men of London, who were now refusing to help him, they'd all agreed to say the very words which had sent Brembe to his death. Richard II clearly decided it was time to teach London a lesson. The king was to show them His Majesty came with steel. After London refused to offer names to become knights and then refused to pay him £1,000, the king moved swiftly to crush the city. On the 13th of May 1392, the king issued a writ to move the Court of Common Pleas to York, where it also moved his treasury and the chancellery. As always when this happened, this was a serious blow to the trade of the city, as it reduced the business the courts generated in the city itself and made it much harder for London's merchants, because they could not enforce their debts unless they made a long journey to York or paid someone to go up there for them. This blow, however, was just the king's opening act. On the 29th of May 1392, the king suddenly summoned the mayor, the sheriffs, the aldermen, and 24 of the, quote, more sufficient, unquote, men of the city to appear before the royal council at Nottingham. This group duly attended and walked into an ambush. The new mayor, John Hend, and the sheriffs were removed from office and imprisoned, ostensibly for their bad government of the city. The position of mayor was dissolved entirely. The city suddenly placed under the direct royal rule, and one of the king's council, Sir Edward Dalyngringy, was made warden of London. New sheriffs of the city were appointed. Now, both were from London, an ironmonger called Thomas Mugfield and a mercer named Thomas Newington. But these were lower-ranked merchants of the city, neither of whom could ever normally have held such lofty positions. And both were loyal to the crown. One of them already served the king in several minor capacities. This was the first time in 70 years that the city had had the mayor dissolved and was under direct royal control. And the shock of impact of this would have been immense. But the thing is, King Richard II would have known this in advance. You see, he had seen firsthand during the Peasant Revolt a decade earlier what Londoners were capable of when they were angry and had the right leadership. So he quickly moved to cut off the head of any remaining opposition back in the city. The most high profile of London's leaders right now was the alderman John Hadley. Hadley was no longer the firebrand he had been in 1369, but he was respected by all in the city and had often been chosen by the City of London to represent it in Parliament in times of crisis. The king probably calculated that a man of his personality and powers of persuasion, with his long experience and struggles with the crown, would become a focal point of resistance from the residents. He decided it was best if John Hadley was out of the way. And so the day after King Richard removed the mayor, he appointed Hadley the mayor of Calais Staple. It's a promotion, a tribute to his skill. The state needed someone well respected to oversee such an important wool market. Well done, old chap. Now, get on to the naffing ship we've arranged for you and piss off to France like a good boy. And don't worry, the king has arranged for a by-election in your ward to pick a new alderman. Bye-bye. With Hadley gone, London didn't even have a chance to form any opposition. And soon afterwards, the king appointed a special commission of inquiry into the nature of the government of the City of London. Two of its leading members were the king's uncles, the Duke of Gloucester and the Duke of York. And the commission got to work straight away. They interrogated first the deposed mayor and his sheriffs. And then they summoned to Eton on the 18th of July not only the sitting alderman, but William Venor, who had been mayor back in 1389 and 90, and the two sheriffs, and all the aldermen who had held office during his term in office. Why they chose to investigate Venor's mayoralty is not clear, except that he was one of the leading staplers and had been accustomed to lend heavily to the crown. King Richard may have suspected he was responsible for the city's refusal to continue either private or public loans. Furthermore, by involving the aldermen who were in office during Venor's mayoralty, that meant he could round up a man who he very much wanted to see brought before him, the former mayor, Exton. Richard had never forgotten that it was Exton who had refused to hold London for him. All these men were summoned to Eton, and they were speedily obliged to confess their faults to the government, and ended up being fined a total of 3,000 marks of silver. The king then withdrew all of London's liberties and replaced Dallin Greenwich as warden with a much more tougher Baldwin Raddington, who almost certainly had been Brembe's chief link to the court back in 1387, and had actually subsequently married Nicholas Brembe's widow. The king then appropriated the entire income of the city of London, and then to top it all off, he fined the city and its residents the staggering sum of £100,000, to be paid in cash, of course. In the space of a few weeks, London had effectively, economically and politically, been destroyed. Now, to give them their due, the aldermen of London soon were able to work out that the cause of all these woes was simply because they had refused to lend the king money. This was, fundamentally, a shakedown. It was also made clear to them, probably by Raddington, saying this to their faces behind closed doors, that their punishments might be reduced or even, you know, utterly forgiven if they spent lavishly to regain the king's favour. Pay up and press his majesty, boys, or else you're screwed. London has always been populated by realists, and it was time to suck up to the king and just throw money at him. And so London laid on a show. On the 21st and 22nd of August, 1392, in glorious sunshine, it was decided to organise a grand procession and ceremony for the king and his queen. The city was lavishly decorated for the occasion. Wine flowed along the water conduits, and all the livery companies were out and forth, clothed in their finest new livery and adding to the regalia of the day. The king was given the sword and keys of the city of London, the first time that this token act of submission was ever recorded. To King Richard II, with his memories of 1381 and 1387, this outward sign of the humbling of this proud city was filled with the dramatic symbolism which he adored. And later, right, he could indulge in the symbolism by making this massive song and dance about him restoring the sword and the keys later in that day as a big sign of him pardoning London. On the second day, the king and queen dined in the city and were presented with hideously expensive, exotic and valuable gifts. But despite this lavish expenditure and the sign of his pardon, the reconciliation was followed by no official pardon, and there was no move to restore the city's liberties. It was not until the 19th of September did the king issue pardons to both mayors Venor and Hend and reduce the £100,000 fine, although the chronicles at the time do not agree by how much, so we don't know. The city's liberties were restored, but only, quote, until the king shall otherwise ordain, unquote. But the slow relaxing of the king's firm grip over London seems to have only happened when we look at the rise of a grocer called William Staunton, who was elected as one of the new aldermen who took the place of those convicted earlier in the council at Nottingham. William Staunton had been a prominent wool exporter, and had served frequently as an alderman and a member of the Commons since 1383. But crucially, from the king's point of view, he came from a family which had traditionally been court purveyors and financiers. And, significantly, he'd not sat as an alderman during the three contentious years of 1390 to 92. And it becomes clear that he was chosen to become an alderman in 1392 as the king's man to lead the city into submission to the royal will. And one of the biggest signs was he was sworn into office before the king in person in Westminster. Staunton basically became the man charged with responsibility of getting London to raise the large sum of money which was needed to pay for the fine. But there was more to it than that. It does seem from subsequent events that the king saw in Staunton really a successor to Nicholas Brembe. Richard had learnt from bitter experience back in the 1380s that he must control London if he were to rule without more challenges from Gloucester or his fellow Lords Appellant. And London, as Brembe had taught him, could be won over by a mixture of both hope and fear. London had just had the fear that they'd seen the king's power to inflict harm, but now it had to be given hope, and the king was about to show how generous he could be and how he had the power to restore all. But first they had to pay for it, pay for the right to get into his good graces. London went back on its spending spree and lavish gift-giving. Firstly, they made expensive presents to the king's uncles, and then at Christmas they gave the king and the queen valuable jewels fashioned in the form of a camel and an exotic bird. According to one source, these presents earned the Londoners, at the queen's request, a remission of £20,000 from the fine. It also seems likely that the jewels were accepted as half of a payment required still going, and the other half was given in cash, because in February 1393 the king acknowledged receipt of £10,000 from London. Out of the public eye, however, and the records of formal receipts, more serious bargaining was evidently going on between Staunton and the king. This would explain why the Londoners were said to pay, quote, with a good heart, unquote, and why one account recorded, quote, great joy in the people, unquote, when the king's emissaries went to the Guildhall. The king was going to be generous, and Staunton was arranging it so. And in the January of 1393, Parliament petitioned the Crown to remove those key provisions of the Statute of York allowing foreigners freedom to trade, which the Lords Appellants had reimposed on the city in 1388. There can be no doubt that the Londoners were the authors of this petition. The King's reply was favourable, and the statute was duly passed. It declared that the Statute of York and its later amendments, quote, if they shall be fully holden and executed, shall extend to the great hindrance and damage of the city of London as of other cities, boroughs and towns of the realm, unquote. And the king proceeded to restore the commercial privileges which London's counted as the core of their ability to make it rich. No non-Londoner was now allowed to sell merchandise to another non-Londoner for them to sell on within the realm. No non-Londoner was to retail merchandise except victuals. And even so, wine and spices were only to be sold wholesale. Furthermore, spices were not to be re-exported by anyone. These concessions made William Staunton a hero in London, and his success was not yet done. The king gave the city three more concessions that same Parliament. He granted the Londoners' petition that Farringdon Ward should be divided into two to allow a second alderman because of a massive population explosion there. He also modified the statute of 1354, which dealt with the punishment of cities' transgressions, so it could not be used against the Londoners that he'd just done it just there now. And thirdly, Staunton secured a significant concession that the aldermen should be allowed to remain in office without submitting to annual elections, basically become aldermen for life. There was, of course, a price for all this generosity from the king, and it seems to have been another 5,000 marks of silver. It was raised by a new tax of 40 pence in the pound on all land and rent, and by contributions of the city's livery companies, and by loans, and by other means. We should not be surprised to read in source documents that many citizens fled from London to avoid the taxation, and that the clergy and the widows of London went so far as to petition Parliament in January 1394 that they should be spared this new tax. The mayor and the aldermen and the common council counter-petitioned Parliament, saying it was only just that all the groups in London should pay for having it been restored to the king's favour. And meanwhile, there was not one protest made by the Common Council, nor apparently any other citizen, against the ending of the annual elections of aldermen. They had in any case made little difference to the class of men chosen as aldermen, and since Brembe had made it possible for them to be re-elected without a year's intermission, annual elections had become a formality by now. Yet for the young king, the restoration of lifelong aldermen meant that his plans for securing an alliance with the city was made easier. Once he'd secured the support of the majority of the aldermen, there was little chance he would lose that support, except if too many of them died. For the merchant class, Staunton's achievements in 1394 were probably more important than the full confirmation of the city's liberties, which was to come a few years later at the cost of 10,000 marks. The merchants and mercantile elements of London's crafts believed that only through the recovery of their commercial privileges could they protect themselves against competition from beyond the city walls. It should be noted that once a new statute had been passed restoring these privileges, Staunton took immediate steps to control the evening markets of Westcheap and Cornhill, and he made subject to inspection by masters of the registered trade guilds. The retailers and the tradesmen, therefore, had reason to be grateful to Staunton, as they had reason now to welcome a reconciliation with the king. And the ironic thing is, London, as it had learned to do ever since the reign of King Canute, and as it had done during the reigns of William the Conqueror or Edward I, once it had gained the good favour of a powerful and angry king, they never turned against him again. London clearly did not like Richard II, but the ambivalent attitude of London's merchant class to Richard in the last years of his reign is shown by the fact that, even if they were never willing to fight on his behalf, neither did they lead the opposition against him. After Richard's forced reconciliation with the Londoners, it seemed that he followed a deliberate policy of winning over to his side the principal aldermen by awarding rich contracts to them, and many Londoners benefited from his patronage on a large scale, and these aldermen, well, they were remarkably slow to offer their support later to the man who would depose the king. The recovery of the city's commercial privileges was all the more vital to the Londoners because financial power was rapidly moving back into the hands of Italians. While Northern Europe was suffering from a lack of money because of the exhaustion of the silver mines of Bohemia, the Venetians were opening new silver mines in Bosnia and Serbia. In a bullion-starved world, those merchants who had stocks of coins to back up their credit could corner markets and control the business of foreign exchange really quick. Their 1390 saw the Florentines return to force in London, where they recovered their old domination of the ecclesiastical and foreign exchange and concentrated particularly on importing spices. In 1394, the Venetian Senate decided to send two state galleys a year to London instead of one galley which they'd sent the previous decade. It was not only the grocers, though, whose trade was threatened by them. Besides their imports of spices, the Venetians brought from Italy the rich fabric sold by the mercers, and they also imported from the Low Countries linen, napery, tapestries, coverlets, and a wide range of the manufactures of the goods which the mercers would hope to import to return for their exports of cloth. Mercers and grocers of London now had a common interest in combining to protect themselves against the Italians, and the cooperation between them helps to explain the abolition of annual elections for aldermen and also William Staunton's choice as sheriff for the year 1393. There were remaining lines of demarcation between the grocers and the mercers' companies, and that remained because of the decision by the Genoese in 1397 to move their principal market back from Southampton to Bruges. And they did this because it became clear that the return of the English wool staple to Calais would be permanent. Therefore, going forward, those merchants who were chiefly interested in importing the raw materials for cloth making continued, therefore, to gravitate towards the grocer's company and to commit themselves to the wool trade and be all up in the Calais staple. Those who were interested chiefly in selling finished cloth joined or affiliated with the mercer's or draper's company and exported English cloth to Middleburg and Antwerp, importing in return the cheaper cloth manufactured in these provinces. However, for both groups, 1392 marked the end of the acute conflicts over the wool staple which had governed the politics for much of the previous century. Only the occasional threat to make Calais also the staple for cloth and the renewal of licenses to evade the staple were to disturb the relations between these groups in the future. The shortage of bullion encouraged everybody's re-cooperation, both at home and overseas. The reality of the economic contraction caused by that massive credit crunch was that the grocers who could not get payment for the dyes and alum and cash accepted finished cloth in exchange, and they either sold it to the mercers or the drapers in London, or joined an amorphous group of cloth exporters from several London livery companies who were developing their own organisation of merchant adventurers within the Merchants' Company. The lack of cash in London was seeing crime spike. It's worth saying about now that Geoffrey Chaucer, who is, as we said last episode, in charge of the King's estate, was on his way to see the King in Eltham when he had barely cleared out of Westminster before he was, quote, feloniously despoiled, unquote, of £10. Yep, Geoffrey Chaucer was mugged, even if he was on the King's business. But he carried on and got as far as New Cross region, where he was attacked again, and the remaining £9, 3 shillings and 6 pence he was carrying was taken from him. Luckily, he was told he didn't have to pay these back, but yeah, times were clearly tight and folks were clearly desperate, including the rich dudes. As early as October 1389, the mayor, the aldermen and the commonalty all agreed on measures which cut down on the cost of processions when the sheriff and the mayors were to be sworn in at the Exchequer. It was agreed that the sheriff should go by water or on foot to Westminster and not ride there, so that the men of the livery companies who accompanied him should not have the expense of hiring horses. It was also agreed that they didn't have to buy new liveries every year for that occasion. But ultimately, the King's continuing financial pressure on the city in the 1390s made men reluctant to expose themselves to his demand by seeking election as aldermen. Others didn't want to be aldermen because they were too busy trying to save their businesses from collapse. The grocers were to see the number of their aldermen drop from 8 at the start of the decade to just 3 at the end. More and more, aldermen and other city officials started becoming people who gained the post as a reward for them giving the king money. And we see in 1393 the first mention of one such man. As the records say, on Sunday the 21st of October that year, and in the presence of some of the political giants of London of its previous decade, quote, in the presence of William Staunton, Mayor, Adam Bam, William Venner, John Faces, Thomas Knowles, and of very many commoners of all the wards of the city, for the election of sheriffs of Guildhall of said city summoned, the said mayor chose Richard Whittington, and the aforesaid commonality chose Drew Berriton to be sheriffs of London for the ensuing year, unquote. Richard Whittington. Dick Whittington enters London's records for the first time in a senior position, and this future four-time mayor of the city was to become emblematic of the city to come. The majesty of King Richard II irrevocably changed the nature of London. His majesty brought an end to everything that had gone before. The intense and violent political debates of London we'd seen over the previous 40 years or so, especially the last dozen years. He had ended much of the status quo of that time and created a political culture of London that was not as strong as it had been. Oh, London was not done being a vast political force upon the country. In times to come, London was to once again be the capital of radical movements opposed to the kings of England. But that lay in the future. But for now, London had been tamed. London had been humbled. the final traces of that kingdom of London that had picked kings like Harold I and Edmund Ironsides, and which had survived in various forms the privations of Edward I and Edward III, and had helped in its own way humble King John and Henry III and Edward II. That London was gone, and the future lay before them, uncertain and filled with new horizons. And I'm going to leave it there. Hope you enjoyed that. Thanks for listening. I hope you're still able to follow along and enjoy the story of London. We're rapidly approaching the 15th century. Yeah. Right, anyway, if you did like it and you want to show your like, the principal way you can do that is just by leaving a 5-star review or a 5-star rating, and I really appreciate that. If anybody wants to help us with our ongoing costs, run the podcast, then you can make a contribution at the Buy Me a Coffee page. And if you are a member or not a member, but you do make contributions, or if you're just curious, you can always drop me a question on there and I will happily try to answer it. And really, honestly, if you have any questions, I did say this in the first episode, if people are interested in me going over different things, let me know. I will try to address it. Of course, if you're listening to this at a later date, I may not get round to it for a while, but yeah, that's how it goes. Anyway, thanks for listening. I will speak to you next week for another chapter in the story of London.